Birdo, tougher bluff. Rates of ADHD decrease at higher altitudes. What do you think? Do you think that rates of ADHD among people, adults and children, do they decrease at higher altitudes, right? You know, going up the mountain?
Are we at sea level right now?
In Seattle, we are at sea level, yes.
What were we talking about? Okay, I will go tough. I think the thinner air, so once you get adjusted, you have more oxygen in your bloodstream, which stimulates your brain further, which makes you less susceptible to ADHD. Hmm.
Fine hypothesis. You are right. It's tough. In the United States, this study is only involving the United States, higher elevation cities have lower rates of ADHD. Wait, weren't you agreeing with something differently?
No, I said that it gets better as you go high.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah. Doesn't make a lot of sense, right?
Because I was saying it gets better as you go high because you carry more oxygen in your blood and therefore your brain gets more oxygen. Although in reality, it probably doesn't get more oxygen because it balances out. So never mind. But I'm still tough.
That's right. Yeah. Well, for whatever reason.
I was actually thinking about you go there and then you come back to sea level.
Right. So for whatever reason, it has been found that higher elevation cities like
Bogota,
Denver, well, in the United States they only analyzed the United States, at higher elevation cities have lower rates of ADHD. Now, there, you know, is obviously speculation from that point forward. Is it the lack of oxygen? Is it this? Is it that? I imagine that there's a lot of factors that go into this. It's also possible that for whatever reason, culturally speaking, the further you get away from the coastal regions of the United States, the more likely you're going to have a more conservative diagnostic analysis of ADHD by practitioners. So it's just harder to tell. You know what I mean? All right. Well, it is not hard to tell that this is the podcast called Psychology in Seattle, and it is definitely not hard to tell that I am your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program, and I am also a licensed therapist.
And my name is Humberto Castañeda, and I'm a Spanish tutor to the celebrities of California.
We all speak Spanish in some ways.
Sí, señor.
Yeah. Burrito.
Tacos.
Refried beans. Right. All right. Tougher bluff, Berto. Genetics seem to be a major factor in a student's motivation at school. I used this one on Facebook recently, so maybe you got it from there. But what do you think? Tougher bluff. Genetics seem to be a major factor in a student's motivation at school.
I'm going to have to go tough.
Why?
I'm not going to say it's the only factor. It doesn't even say it's the main factor.
It says it's a major
factor. But it's a major factor. I gotta say that, fine. I'm just saying that if the genetics have predisposed the individual to having less neurotic behaviors, less ADHD, less, compulsive behaviors, less aggression, less this, less that, and more of all the positive traits, then they're probably going to do better at school. And then if that's reinforced by their surroundings and their environment, then even better. So I'm going to go tough.
I like it. I think I would agree with you. It is tough. According to a twin study, half of the variance is nature while the other half is nurture.
Aha.
We've talked about this before. It's hard to quantify these sorts of things.
Yeah.
But in general, a lot of things are said to be half related to nature, meaning your genetics, and half related to nurture, meaning your environment. All right, tougher bluff. 90-minute naps decrease memory performance. Tougher bluff. So naps that are 90 minutes long have been found to decrease performance of memory.
Bluff. I seem to remember that you want to go in half-hour increments and that an hour and a half seems like a good period of time to increase your memory performance. I'm going to go bluff.
Well, you're right. Your justification is a little strange, but it's the opposite. It increases memory performance, 90-minute naps.
Yeah. Yeah, because, well, what I read was that the rhythm in the brain sleep cycle is like chunked to half-hour increments.
That's not true.
Or something like that.
No. In general, the advice is you should keep your naps to under a half an hour. That's the general advice.
All right.
Once you go beyond that, then you should probably just have a full night's sleep.
So this data might have been wrong. The thing I was reading is that it was better to sleep 7.5 hours than sleep 8 hours.
That I have not read, and that does not match up with my understanding of sleep. It's more related to where you wake up in the sleep cycle and whether or not you enter into REM sleep. I believe, and I might have to look this up later, that when you nap, you don't want to go into REM sleep. You just want to have a cat nap where you just fall asleep you go into early stages of sleep and then you wake up. Because if you go into REM and then wake up, then it can be very disruptive to you.
Depends on the song, but yeah.
Right. And when it comes to 8 hours versus 9 hours versus 7 hours, it depends on a lot of factors and a lot of things that they don't know about because everyone's different. But in general, you want to wake up, quote unquote, naturally when your sleep cycle starts to naturally come up, if that makes any sense. Emerging from deep sleep to lesser levels of sleep to waking up, as opposed to waking up in the middle of deep sleep.
That's what I do. I have this really loud Star Wars alarm. And when it goes off and C-3PO is like talking to R2-D2 and R2-D2 is going, beep, 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 I naturally wake up.
Yeah. I don't know a lot about sleep, so I could be talking out of my butt a little bit. So forgive me for that. It's not really my area because I'm not a physician or a sleep.
Do you remember that alarm, by the way? C-3PO, this little rebel is going to be late.
No, really?
Yeah, you shouldn't be so bright, because R2-D2 goes, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and C-3PO goes, R2, you shouldn't be so bright. This little rebel is going to be late.
Oh my gosh, I want one. All right, another tougher bluff. Expressing gratitude improves your sleep and lowers your inflammation. Tougher bluff. I also use this one on Facebook. Perhaps you saw it.
Yeah, and I actually commented on this one. I made a joke, but I'm going to double down on my joke. I'm going to say... Bluff, because I'm always saying thanks, Obama, all day long, and it like still pisses me off and makes me stressed.
I just got that joke. I saw your comment on Facebook. I had no idea what you were referring to, and I just got it.
Thanks, Obama.
It is such a layered, obscure joke that
all the right wingers are always like, thanks, Obama.
Right.
So I think the lesson is if you're sarcastically thanking people,
right,
it probably doesn't help you.
Yeah. I really sometimes wonder the string of events in your mind that get you to certain punchlines. I mean, to you, you've built up the connection, and it's hilarious to you. But to everyone else, it's like a stand-up comedian walks up and says a joke in his mind without saying it out loud, and then says the punchline at the end, and then just laughs out loud to himself, and everyone's like, I don't get it.
27 books!
Exactly. All right. Another one here. Tougher bluff. Regarding taking risks, younger teens are most influenced by what other teens think, while older teens, children and adults, so, you know, non-tweeners, are most influenced by adults' view of risk. So this is a complicated one. So taking risks, younger teens, as opposed to all the other teens and all the other people, are most influenced by what other teens think. Whereas other people, older teens, children, and adults, are most influenced by adults' view of risk rather than peers or children's view of risk. Does this make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I think I'm going to go tough just from my anecdotal personal experience thinking that when you first reach that new stage in life called teenagehood, I think you get a little bit of the, okay, I'm almost an adult here, like, and my friends seem to know what they're talking about. And yeah, why not skip school or why not do this or whatever? And maybe after a few years of that, you realize, maybe there's more to this than I thought. And so then you settle back down a little bit. But the age range might vary between people. So I'm going to go tough.
You're right. It's tough. And that is perfectly good speculation. They don't know why this is true, but it is found in the data. And I find this interesting, particularly because what they found was younger teens, as opposed to older teens, are particularly influenced by their peers. Whereas older teens, by the, so it's like when you're 13, you're like, adults are idiots. My fellow friends who are 13-year-old children are geniuses. And then you become 17 and you've realized through experience that your peers are idiots and that adults are less of idiots. Let's just put it that way. So I just find that to be interesting. And I think it provides a lot of context to the way that parents get frustrated with their young teenagers, because that's the time. And incidentally, as a family therapist, I often will tell this to my students, is that the vast majority of my clients, when it's families, when it's teenagers, are families with 13 or 14-year-olds.
Right.
That's kind of when the shit hits the fan. 12 years old, not a lot of clients. 17 years old, some clients as individuals, but not a lot of 17-year-olds being dragged into therapy the way that 13 and 14-year-olds are.
You know, one of the things that starts happening at that crossover point is, I'm not saying it's the only issue, but there's this new aspect to your life, which is sexuality. And for a lot of people, it's not actually something you freely discuss and engage with your parents. So it's almost like there's this new secretive part of your life built into your system, which means that you and your friends are actually talking about it, but you don't really discuss it with adults because it might be embarrassing, or it might be, you might be doing things you might think you're not supposed to, like kissing girls or guys or whatever it is, right? You might be looking at pornography. Oh no, I can't tell anyone about that, right? But your friends, you can. You're sharing that with your friends. So I could see how that forms a bond where you're like, oh yeah, well, we're now very close on this thing. Sure, let's go rob the liquor store, which, you know, we all do. And then you realize that it was probably not so good. So then you try a bank and then you get more money, but then eventually it leads to drug trafficking. But after you have enough money, you finally realize your parents might be right.
Right. And that is why it is good advice to parents to try to listen to your children rather than shut them down, if that makes any sense. So a 13-year-old says, you know, can I go on a date with, you know, Joey or something? Instead of going, no, you're completely barred from dating people until you're 35. Instead of saying something like that, you know, have a conversation with them. You don't have to let them go on a date with Joey, because everyone knows Joey is
Joey's trouble.
Joey's bad news bears, but have a conversation, you know, allow there to be some back and forth. And if you can allow for that, if you can cultivate that, and some teenagers will refuse to participate in that, but if you can manage that, my guess is that you won't have this divide between young teens and their parents.
The problem is Joey's so cute, though.
I know. The bad boys always are.
Ugh.
All right, tough or bluff. Frequent use of the words I and me is associated with an increased likelihood of narcissism. So when people verbally written word use words like I and me more often, there's a greater likelihood that they are narcissistic. What do you think? Tough or bluff?
I think, for me, anyways, I could see that.
I, me.
I could even see that in me.
Me, I.
I'll go tough. That's
you, but me. And I.
I'm going to go tough because for me, that makes sense.
It makes sense intuitively, but it is bluff.
Oh.
According to empirical research, it is found that there is no association between pronoun use and narcissism.
Aha.
This flies in the face of common wisdom and some published statements. I have seen news articles saying that you can tell how narcissistic someone is by counting how many times they use the word I or me in a particular piece.
I have also seen those.
Right. Which I always love when science actually disproves stuff like this.
Yeah.
Because to reduce personality and something as complicated as narcissism to the number of times someone uses a particular word is ridiculous to me. And so I love it when empirical science shoots this sort of stuff down.
Although I bet you that in the press announcement, the scientist was like, I have single-handedly disproved what I have been saying.
All right, let's do some emails. What do you think?
Woo!
This one is from a listener that I won't name because I'm not sure if he would want me to say his name. Incidentally, out there, if the email is particularly personal, I won't mention your name. If I believe it's not that big of a deal, then I'll just mention your first name, and I'll probably leave out things that I just try to use my own judgment whenever I'm reading emails online. So I'm not going to say this person's name. But anyway, he says, one person told me that no matter how beautiful a woman is, a person still can't experience a stronger orgasm with her than one he experiences if he simply masturbates. Is it really true? Even if one day I have sex, this person has not had sex before, I still won't be able to experience a stronger orgasm than the one I experienced when I simply masturbate. So again, this person is very inexperienced with sex and is actually an adult and is having trouble socializing with people. But he says, one person told me that no matter how beautiful a woman is, which I find to be an interesting kind of word choice there, no matter how beautiful a woman is, a person still can't experience a stronger orgasm with her than the one he experiences if he simply masturbates. What do you think about that, Berto?
That is a very interesting question. I would say, not clinically or anything, just from as a probably older person than the email person in question, I would say that sex in general is really variable, and it is dependent on too many variables to make it like into this neat little formula. So that means that it's not just about, you know, is it your hand? Was it the type of lotion? Was it the time of day? What were you looking at? What had happened yesterday? Who is it? Is her face pretty? It's not like it's a combination of things. So sometimes you'll have the most amazing sex with someone, and it turns out she's okay looking, but she was really into it, and she said just the right things, and you felt really comfortable with her, and it was amazing. Other times you might have a supermodel and it might be cold. It might not be very engaging. One day your hand might be the best thing ever. The next day you might just be very mechanical and not that engaged. So in the end, I would say A, probably not generally true at all. B, do not close yourself off to human experience with the assumption that you are self-sufficient, not only in sex, but in everything.
Right. I would agree with at least most of that, if not all. I have actually never heard the idea, the notion that the beauty, quote unquote, of a woman means that the more beautiful a woman is, the stronger your orgasm is. I've never even heard that before. It doesn't make really any sense to me. And also, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, one. Two, what do you mean by stronger orgasm? Is this a longer in length? Is it self-reported, you know, pleasure index? You know, two, is it how far you manage to you know,
distance?
Yeah. You know, there, by what measure is strength of orgasm? The other thing is that, you know, sexuality is intertwined, as Berto, you were mentioning, in our attachment, in love, in romance. You could have a super intense orgasm and hate the person that you're with and not be attracted to them at all. So it really is a confluence of many things. In general, what I was saying to him over email was that I recommend that he focus on connecting emotionally with other people and attempting to cultivate a mutually satisfying sexual experience with that loved person, rather than focusing on the strength of orgasm or how beautiful the person is. Because sex is usually more satisfying in a relational context, regardless of the strength of orgasm.
Yeah. I mean, just the other day, I was with four Sports Illustrated bikini models at a beach. And, you know, we had sex for like 8 hours, and it was great and all, but not the best I've had. So, you know, you never know.
Yeah. Listener Zoe wrote in and said that she votes. Remember how we were asking for votes on what to call the listeners?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, and we were coming up with no good ideas. Well, listener Zoe votes to call the listeners the pun-loving Kirk Burdos.
That's easy. What's the acronym there?
P-L... Pluckbees.
Pluckbees.
The Pluckbows. God. Okay.
The piss plucks. The piss plucks. Piss poor plucks.
All right. Another listener wrote in and says, I'm summarizing email here. Just wanting to say thanks for your podcast, which I find both informative and entertaining. I have been in therapy for around 2 years for PTSD and have a very good bond with my therapist. I have come to accept that the process is slow and progress will always be incremental, but one thing I continue to find difficult is not knowing exactly what success will look like or what I can expect at the end. My trauma is from childhood, so I really have no reference point for what I as a person might look like without PTSD. So I was wondering if you could share some of your experiences of A, how long treatment can take for PTSD in cases similar to mine, i.e., a trauma from childhood, and B, what the end result can look like, i.e., what's the best possible outcome you've personally seen and or what's the most common. Do you have any comments, bro?
I do. Now, I'm not going to comment directly on this is how long PTSD therapy should take or something. What I'm going to say is just from my personal experience with therapy, I will definitely say that therapy for me is not something that I have been able to measure in terms of milestones or, you know, after the first N number of time in therapy, then I reached this point, and then from there on I did this. It's been a lot more malleable than that. And so my experience with it has been that through doing it over time, almost without noticing at first, some of my behaviors start improving. Some of my difficulties start getting better. So that when I start looking back and reflecting, I'm like, wow, I've really overcome these aspects. I still have these aspects, these challenges, but I've really seemed to have overcome these other ones. And it's never as trivial as, oh, clearly, I remember that session when I had this beautiful breakthrough. And then from there on, my life was wonderful. That it's not really been like that. It's more, I remember all those conversations we had about this topic. And in aggregate, it seems to have helped.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Also, when it comes to childhood PTSD, childhood trauma, often, and the listener didn't mention this, but often it involves someone in your family.
Yeah.
Say, for instance, being physically abused by a parent or sexually abused by a relative. This is what we call complicated trauma as opposed to simple trauma. Simple trauma is you get in a car accident or you have a botched surgery and you see blood spurting everywhere. That's traumatizing and you can have PTSD afterwards. But if you've been repeatedly abused by someone that you love, that's someone that you depend on, then not only do you have the trauma of being afraid, but it's also repeated over time, and it relates to trust of other people, it relates to your emotional regulation, it relates to who you are as a person, and it's much more ingrained in your personality. And so the treatment of complicated PTSD is really much different, much more long-term, and involves a lot of relational elements in therapy. I've treated people with PTSD from simple trauma, even though it was a relational trauma event. She had been broken up with, or no, she discovered that her husband was cheating on her. And very suddenly she found out, and it was very traumatic for her. So even though it was relational trauma, the treatment of the PTSD showed that it was very simple because it only took like 15 sessions or something. And she went from being extremely symptomatic in the beginning with PTSD to zero symptoms. And I actually used a self-report measure to measure PTSD symptoms. And so that's another thing you can look at, listener that wrote in. You can look at different measures of depression, anxiety, and there's specific measures for PTSD, particularly the TSI. Two, I believe it's called. I should know that. Trauma Symptom Inventory, the second edition. So you can look at that to gauge whether or not therapy is working. If you have PTSD and you're getting therapy over time, one of the best ways to measure whether or not therapy is working is whether or not your symptoms on a scale from 1 to 10 have actually gone down. And these measures actually address various different domains within PTSD, because PTSD is quite elaborate in its symptom constellation, symptom structure. And so you need kind of an elaborate measure to measure all those different things. So that's one thing. The other thing is she asks how long treatment can take for this sort of PTSD. Again, if it's simple trauma, it can take anywhere from 5, 10, 15 sessions, whereas if it's complicated trauma, it could take years. In my experience, it takes years to treat particularly difficult cases of complicated PTSD. Because the client needs to end up relearning a whole new approach to other people. They need, through the relational experience in therapy, through the relationship with the therapist and other important attachment figures, the client becomes essentially reparented in a way that is more functional. For instance, if you have a father that's alcoholic and physically abusive and scary, you have, you know, potentially 20 years of your first 20 years learning that men are extremely volatile, scary, uncaring, mean, abusive people. Well, that lesson is going to be hard to unlearn. You're going to have to experience intense relational experiences with people that you really depend on, perhaps a therapist, perhaps a spouse, perhaps a family member, in which you experience very secure, very safe, very caring kinds of people to get it into your deep brain that you can trust other people. Because when we don't trust people and when we are scared of people, we tend to recreate difficult relational experiences to, again, re-traumatize us. For instance, if you grow up with complex trauma and you expect, you know, just using the example that I've given, you're a woman, you expect men to be mean, then you are naturally going to be very skittish around men, which makes total sense, right? And then men will tend not to react very well to that because they're being treated in a particular way. And then the men might reject you and might be mean to you and might actually move away from you. And this will, again, reaffirm the idea that people cannot be trusted. And so that sort of relational, and this has been empirically found to be the best treatment for complicated PTSD, is relational kinds of therapies, in addition to some other kinds of therapies. And those kinds of therapies can take years. So, for instance, to answer your question, I don't know how long treatment will take for you, but it could take a long time.
3 weeks.
Yeah, maybe four. No, I would say on in the order of years, and perhaps even I've treated people since I've been in practice for 20 years. I've treated people with complicated PTSD off and on for many years. They'll go to therapy for a few years. They'll drop out of therapy for a couple of years. They'll come back for another year. They'll drop out. It's really a difficult thing, and a lot of therapy is needed. So there's that. The other thing is what the end result can look like. She's asking. You know, what do we personally have seen? Well, again, I think I explained what complex or what simple PTSD, the end result of therapy, means. You're symptom free, meaning meaning that the triggers no longer trigger you, no longer make you feel anxious. But when it comes to complex PTSD, it's really hard because if you had a father that was physically abusive every day of your life for 20 years, that's a part of you. That's a part of your history. You're never going to shed that history. And so the end result means that the PTSD symptoms have reduced, if not gone away, and one has the ability to trust others appropriately and build relationships that are mutually satisfying, which sounds like an easy thing to do, but for those who have been traumatized, it can be actually very hard to do that. Does that make sense, Berto?
Yeah. I mean, again, if I relate it to some of the stuff I've been through, and I probably have a smorgasbord of things that I've been dealing with throughout my adult life that were generated in my infancy and young years and stuff like that. One of them was, and I've talked about this before, addiction to purchasing things, including clothing. In my case, when I overcame that, the result looked like this. It looked like I no longer felt a compulsion to walk into a store and buy very expensive clothes just because. And so it's kind of a very like, well, duh. But that was literally what I had before and what all of a sudden I no longer felt. So it was actually this liberating feeling of like, you know, there's this store that's very nice, has very nice clothing that's very expensive called David Lawrence. And I used to get calls for a while afterwards still, hey, you haven't been in here for a while. We have a new sale. We have awesome jackets, awesome pants. And they would call me because I used to be one of their best customers because I'd walk in and drop thousands, right? But that used to be a real pull for me. when I overcame that, and again, it took a series of like a couple of years of therapy and a series of dips and finally a few big blows to finally like mentally switch, right? But after that, really the outcome was, oh, I don't need to go there. And you walk by the clothing store, it's like, I don't need, in fact, so much so that nowadays I don't even have the conversation anymore.
Right.
For a while, the conversation would happen and I would realize, oh, I don't need this. And now it doesn't even happen. So in that case, it was like that.
So that's not related to PTSD.
Not PTSD, but
it demonstrates that with a lot of conversations, I mean, there's a part of you that knew you shouldn't be doing that, that it wasn't.
I knew from the beginning of therapy. In fact, before therapy, I knew that I shouldn't be logically, I knew okay. I shouldn't be spending so much money on stuff.
But you kept doing it.
Yes.
And in therapy, you were able to explore your feelings, explore reasons why you should do it and why you shouldn't do it. And you had a caring person and this sort of thing. And we have suddenly ran out of time. So that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. Please take care of yourself and goodbye.
Goodbye.